This Jocks 94.5 podcast is brought to you by Millennium Satellite and Video. Log on to msvnow.com. TV excellence everywhere. That's Millennium.
Three man front.
Auburn goes to take on a Georgia team that's not a very good team by any stretch of the imagination. Alabama's or Auburn's shooting woes continue. Javon McCormick was the lone bright spot. We talked about the game yesterday leading up to it, what Auburn had to do. They had to get bench help. They got 2 points off the bench. 2 points.
Not enough off the bench. And I think the shooting woes, like you mentioned, is it's interesting because there seems to be this obsession with Auburn being different without Isaac Okoro, which 13.1 points per game, what he does on the defensive side, the size and physicality that he adds. I don't mean to take away from that completely, but when you go 4 of 26 and 1 of 17 in back-to-back games from the three-point line, that's 5 of 43 in two games. That, to me, that's your problem. Now, Isaac Okoro can make up for a lot of that if you continue to shoot that way, and he can add some things, being able to get to the rim, giving you second-chance points, giving you a physical mismatch. But if Auburn continues to shoot like this with Okoro in the lineup, I don't think they're going to be that much of a different team.
I agree with you.
I keep seeing all of these different people, you know, Seth Greenberg, Joe Lunardi, talking about how different Auburn is without Okoro, which obviously they are different. But if you're going to shoot 5 of 43 over a two-game span, it's not going to matter if he's playing or not.
Eventually it's going to catch up with you, and it's caught up with Auburn in a two-game stretch, and it happens to be against two teams that
they should beat.
Yeah,
it's a weird just – watching the game play out, the little bit I saw of it, I was on the road, but I did catch as much as I could on the replay last night before I went to bed. Auburn shot 13 free throws. Now, why that sticks out to me is because the two previous games, they shot 46 against Missouri, and before that, they shot 39 against Alabama. And I know life on the road in the SEC, you're not going to get a lot of calls. But the first time they played Georgia, they only shot 15 free throws. So they're under their season average and free throws against Georgia for whatever reason. But it comes down to, and I'll eat crow on this one. I thought Auburn was a lock, even covering that game. And you guys said, they're not, what about the shooting woes? The shooting woes. And that's what it came down to. Only six assists in the game. And you can't get an assist if people aren't making shots. So, yeah, this team is not coming together at the right time of year.
And it wasn't just the outside shooting. It was shots around the basket that they couldn't get to go.
It was just sloppy. It was sloppy basketball. Offensively, defensively, there was a lot of sloppy basketball from Auburn last night, and it wasn't very enjoyable to watch. And it's when you saw the way that they played, it's not surprising that they lost and had a chance to get in that game late. And I think cut it down to, what, five sort of late in the second half there. And then it was for Georgia, it was kind of a story of runs. I mean, they 13-point run, 9-point run, 11-point run. And then if you're shooting like that, you're not going to be able to keep up with that. But you know, turnovers under the basket, not being able to get second chance points. You know, McCormick, you mentioned, had to be the offensive weapon last night. Well, there goes a lot of your assists if your point guard's a guy that's got to be able to create and score points. And then on top of that, he turned it over five times. I thought turnovers and lack of free throw attempts were the big story for Auburn outside of the 3-point shooting, which was completely miserable. And like going back to Okoro, he's seventh on the team in 3 points attempted and 3-pointers made. So I go to this obsession with, no Okoro. Again, I understand that he can make a difference in a lot of ways, but when you're that bad from behind the three-point line, Isaac Okoro's not your answer.
Okoro has been really good at some of the getting a lot of the 50-50 balls, and also when Auburn is struggling from outside, he's been really good at taking the ball to the basket. That's what he has done.
He can break
and on the defensive
down.
Side
Absolutely.
Of the ball, he's really good too. I do point to last year. Aaron, last year, February 22nd, Auburn got beat by 27 at Rupp Arena. And then they went on that run. I'm not comparing this team to that team, but college basketball is funny week to week. And maybe if they can get Okoro back, they can start hitting that stride as we get into tournament time.
Well, it's sort of the law of averages, right? I mean, I think we were all a little surprised when Auburn went on that run, just through a tear, really, in the toughest part of their schedule in tough games. They had to gut out in overtime games, and they got through that, and you sort of thought, okay, they can breathe again. They can exhale, and it hasn't gone that way because basketball, as you mentioned, it's a weird game and there are ups and downs. It's games of runs, and then you get one of your best players injured, and it's hard to calculate and fully put into context what he means because, as Cole put it out, I mean, he's not a phenomenal shooter, but the way he can create maybe gets open looks for other guys. So there's a lot of stuff that goes into it. They're just not playing real well.
Hey, right. It's interesting you bring up last year, though, because I'll be the first one to admit I was as close to giving up on that team at that point last year as anybody. And they did what they did, and you look at the fact that they have winnable games left on the schedule. Okoro is going to come back. And could Okoro sort of be that, maybe Cambridge, be that Okiki late last year that sort of finds his game heading into the postseason and becomes an even different style difference maker than what they were in the regular season? So I think that's very possible. I'm not throwing in the towel just yet, but I think if you're talking about what you feel like your ceiling is for this team, it has to have changed 100%.
And last night, Bruce Pearl, he unloaded the bench. He tried to get as many guys in there. It was guys that we haven't seen a whole lot of this year getting into the game and getting significant minutes.
You know what I like, though, that Bruce did? And unlike some other coaches, maybe in an emotional, upset press conference, he didn't throw his guys under the bus. I mean, he was very tactful about the way he went about saying that we don't have another Isaac. The guys that we're playing, he put it on himself. I'm not getting them ready to play. Anyway, he didn't say, oh, we don't have the guys.
Steve Sarkisian's name coming up in the Colorado coaching search after Mel Tucker departed. We've heard the name of Eric Bieniemy. We've heard of Brett Bielema, a little bit of Jim McElwain. Brian Harsin's name has been kicked around. Troy Calhoun, the coach at Air Force. But Steve Sarkisian apparently interviewing there in Boulder or with someone representing Colorado.
Yeah, I was on the road to Atlanta yesterday for a speaking engagement when I got word that he was indeed not in Tuscaloosa. He interviewed. I don't know if the interview was in Boulder. A lot of these interviews now take place at airports.
Yeah.
So it could have been in Atlanta. It could have been anywhere. But I do know that he's back in Tuscaloosa today. What that means, I don't know. Maybe he's waiting for Colorado to make a decision. Maybe they've moved on and they let him know he wasn't the candidate. Maybe they let him know that he was their candidate as long as they did their due diligence on him. I don't know. What I do know is his name has been attached to too many jobs, and that's not by coincidence. It lets me know he wants to be a head coach again, and he wants to be a head coach really badly because he's not really exercising any discretion on the job. It's sort of like any Power 5 job that comes open, he's sort of throwing, or his agent is throwing his name in the ring for, which, again, it's not by accident. You know, whether that's because he just really wants to be a head coach again, maybe it's just he wants to make more money again, whatever the reason, it's not a coincidence his name keeps coming up. But he's back in Tuscaloosa. I imagine that Colorado wants to make a decision sooner rather than later because, I mean, we've got spring practice starting when? A couple weeks for at least schools down here. I know Alabama gets started on March 18th. And so you got to get a head coach in place to get some of that. He's got to get hires made. I mean, all that stuff. So they're going to have to make a decision quickly. But it would be horrible timing for Alabama if they lost Steve Sarkisian, you know, March or February 20th, February 21st.
Yeah, well, if that did happen, though, where does Nick Saban go? Who would be the guy that would most likely get tapped to take that place? Would it be an analyst that's currently on staff or a position coach?
I mean, you got a guy that's been your offensive coordinator under Nick Saban there. It wouldn't excite people. I tell you that. I mean, but it's not about really winning the press conference or exciting people. It's about if you think a guy can do the job. And Major Applewhite's been an analyst. He's been there. He was Nick Saban's first offensive coordinator in 2007. Paul Feinbaum, has thrown out the name Hugh Freeze. I know Nick Saban expressed some interest in hiring him a couple years ago. The SEC really wasn't on board with that, but it's been a couple years. But does Hugh Freeze want to leave a head coaching opportunity to go be Nick Saban's offensive coordinator? It's late in the game to go be getting someone.
It's extremely late, and you think about how would that affect potentially Hugh Freeze coming over. He might not want to leave at this point in time.
He's making really, really good money to be where he is at Liberty, and they've given him all the resources that he needs. And he got to a bowl game in his first year. Maybe he sees that going and working for Nick Saban, if he was to leave, that gets him a Power 5 coaching job faster than the track that he's on at Liberty right now. But, I mean, he had success, and he's not starving to death. I mean,
he's not.
He's getting paid a good bit of money.
And maybe the touch of Nick Saban can get him back to a more desirable job if Liberty is not his end road job, which I don't think many of us think it is. But if that's the road he wants to take, I mean, look what he would have to work with. Pretty good like set of tools offensively, right? Offensive line that's got potential. Running backs are all back. You got some wide receivers you can do some things with, and then you got a young, exciting quarterback that you can work with, and you got a guy that's played some football that seemed to develop last year. I'm not trying to be like a caution. I'm not trying to ring any alarm bells, but with this new rule, I mean, I don't think Bryce Young would leave Alabama for Colorado, but Steve Sarkisian is the reason Bryce Young's at Alabama. I mean, that's fact. But, I mean, I can't imagine you leaving Alabama to go to Colorado, but Antonio Alfano did.
You want to win the press conference, bring a five-star quarterback with you as a new coach.
I don't think Bryce Young's going anywhere. No, he shouldn't.
I know it's speculation.
But that relationship with Steve Sarkisian is one of the reasons Nick Saban would really like Sark to stay on another year. I mean, he knows he's not going to stay there long-term, but he thought he would get 2 years out of him. I mean, you really hope that you get 1 year out of him working with Bryce Young.
But let's think about some of the other names that have been mentioned for that job at Colorado. Brett Bielema, he had success at Wisconsin, never really got it going at Arkansas. But when you think about Sark, it's not so much what he did on the field. It was the question marks that surrounded him in his personal life and things that affected him in his daily job duties.
And it's very real. And I think if and when Sark does get a head coaching job, and I think he will get another one, I think he deserves another chance because he's proved that he can manage an offense, manage a team, and he's been a head coach before, so that experience is valuable. But for me, it would be getting out of that guidance and getting out of that structure. When you, for somebody who's had some issues with similar things, when you get away from structure, that's when things go sideways, and that's when bad things happen. I know it firsthand. So for me, the biggest fear for Steve Sarkisian would be getting away from that structure and having to rely on yourself for that structure. That's not an easy thing to do. That's not an easy place to get. If he's there, then I think he can be extremely successful. And he's a much better fit than Brett Bielema is for the Colorado job. I don't even think that's up for debate. You could debate who might be a better head coach, but for that particular spot, Sark's a better fit.
Hey, you want to feel better? Let's take the Duke Blue Devils. They go on the road last night, and they get beat by 22 to NC State. They didn't play very well either.
Largest loss versus an unranked team in Coach K's career. Largest loss since the 2013 NCAA tournament where they lost to Louisville by 22 in the Elite Eight.
If it can happen to Duke, it can happen to anybody. Alabama losing a lead at home last night to Texas A&M.
Boy, where have we heard that before?
Oh.
I mean, when you do the autopsy on Alabama's 2019-2020 college of basketball season, you can point to some tough losses in the offseason or in the out of conference. You can point to blown leads at Florida that would have really helped you and maybe beating Penn State, which have really helped you. But I think it comes down to three games. It comes down to you blew a lead versus Arkansas at home, you blew a lead versus Tennessee at home, you blew a lead versus Texas A&M at home. You win those three games, you're in the tournament probably. Those three games, despite all the other stuff that went on and out of conference you're in, but you can't have 21 turnovers in a game, period. You absolutely can't have 21 turnovers at home. You can't play sloppy basketball. There's no excuse for it. Alabama was up 6 points with 4:18 left, and A&M went on a 12-0 run. You can't allow that in your building. Alabama, again, now, we know they're a jump shooting team. 9 free throws the entire game? 9 at home?
And that was the difference. Texas A&M shoots almost 78% from the line.
And they were hot.
And they attempt 27 free throws and knock down 21 of them. That was the difference of the game.
They hit a lot of threes, too, and they were one of the worst teams in Division I at shooting threes, but they made them against Alabama. But turnovers, 21 at home, it's just who this team is. You got to protect your home court. And Cecil Hurt, friend of the program, had a great stat, and it's sort of the ballad of being an Alabama basketball fan over the last few years. It's the sort of, as you mentioned, Groundhog Day, right? Since 2017, Alabama is 6-11 in SEC home games in the month of February. 6-11 at home. If you can't win at home, that's why they're in the position every year of being a perennial bubble team, and more often than not, they're on the wrong side of the bubble. That's the stat that kills them.
Alabama coach Nate Oates, the Tide, and losing that lead late.
I didn't think we gave the effort there, you know, the last 4 minutes necessary to win the game on the defensive end, and it hurt that we weren't able to have Herb in as much as we'd have liked, just because with the way they played on it, you know, we wanted G really to guard Nebo.
It's an indictment when your coach said you didn't play hard the final 4 minutes of the game.
And that's the thing with this Alabama team. While they're not big, like, they don't really truly have a big man, and they can shoot it, and they shoot it a lot. Scoring is not an issue for Alabama.
Zero rim protection. When A&M is going on that 12-0 run and they go up four, it's because they're going inside. I mean, point-blank shots around the rim. He's basically having to play with a short deck, and he's trying his best to get this team to play. And I guess what's got to be driving him mad is that sometimes they play well, other times they don't. And what's been maddening, I guess, is that some of the times they've played their most inconsistent as of late, when they've really went in this funk, has been at home. And explain that one to me.
We talk about some of the best things that we've seen, best performances, what's happening that's good, what's happening that's fun. We also got to bring you the bad. Every single day, it's the worst thing that I've seen.
This is the worst thing I've seen.
A lot of different directions that we could go with this one today, but we're going to go to the border. El Paso, Texas, federal authorities have filed a criminal complaint against 27-year-old Gregory Keith Robinson and 26-year-old Jaquan Bray. Probably familiar names for Auburn football fans, as they both played for the Auburn Tigers, for conspiracy to possess with intent to distribute marijuana. A lot of marijuana. Approximately 157 pounds of marijuana.
That seems like a lot of marijuana.
That's a Landrum of marijuana. Maybe a little bit more.
Actually, it's close.
It's a little more.
It's like 20 pounds shy of a Landrum.
20 pounds more, you mean. All right, so listen, it's you're trying to smuggle dope into the United States across the border in El Paso. That's one thing. They rented a Chevy Tahoe and took it down into Mexico. They approached the Sierra Blanca checkpoint station, where a U.S. Border Patrol canine unit alerted on their vehicle. The agents asked the driver, Quan Bray, remember that portion of the story, to park the vehicle in the secondary inspection area for further investigation. A subsequent inspection of the vehicle by agents revealed the presence of large duffel bags in the rear cargo area.
Good grief.
Not in the fender.
No.
Not in the gas tank. Not in a homemade tank underneath the vehicle. Not under the hood. Not in the seats.
Duffel bag.
These dudes tossed duffel bags of weed in the back of a rented Tahoe.
Oh, Greg.
Like you rent a car from the United States, drive there, you come back, you don't think that raises a red flag at all?
Now, listen, this story was the worst thing I've seen, because you had a guy that's made close to $50 million in his career bringing 157 pounds of weed across the border to intend to distribute, which maybe they weren't intending on distributing it.
Just smoking a bunch of dope?
I've seen crazier things. That wasn't why this was the worst thing that I have seen. We're still getting to that. It's not even the rented Tahoe. It's not even the 157 pounds of dope stuffed in duffel bags in the rear cargo area of rented Tahoe. The affidavit further states that Robinson rented the vehicle in L.A. on Sunday and had arranged for a third individual in the vehicle to drive he and Bray to Louisiana. That third individual was an Uber driver he met in 2018.
No.
Oh, boy.
No.
When the trio reached El Paso, Robinson instructed Bray to begin driving. So you hired a dude to drive you and potentially be your fall guy, and you didn't let him drive you. When they were stopped for inspection at the Sierra Blanca checkpoint, Robinson asked the third individual, who's not yet been named, and you'll find out why, to claim the marijuana, and that Robinson said he would pay third individual to do so.
By the way,
I'm just going to throw this out to you.
That sounds fair.
You're looking at a 20-year sentence in federal prison?
Federal.
How much would that cost for you to do?
Ooh.
Yeah, I'm going to say...
Lifetime of wealth for...
Like they do on the commercial?
For my family.
Priceless.
And their family and their family.
There is no price point on that. Sorry. Literally $1 billion cash, I wouldn't do it.
No.
If you were guaranteed to serve every day... 20 years
20
in the
years
federal pen?
Nope.
Not $1 billion cash would I do it for.
Nope.
First off, I'm probably not getting out of there.
Yeah, but $1 billion, you know how corrupt.
I'm not making it 20 years.
You know how corrupt guards can be?
No shot.
$1 million, you'd have a nice cell.
Greg made a series of questionable decisions.
Wi-Fi.
Finally, the third individual refused to do so, told Robinson that she would not have driven them had he known there were drugs in the vehicle, which, good news for him, wasn't driving when they got pulled over. Upon conviction, defendants face up to 20 years.
The Houston Astros, so many people have been outspoken about the cheating scandal. It is now trickling down to Little Leagues. You saw did you see there was already two Little Leagues in California that have banned the use of the Astros as one of their teams?
That seems silly.
Well, now... 60 miles east of Williamsport, Pennsylvania, there's a Little League director who is sending that message to 4,000 kids in his league. There will be no Astros in our league this year. No Astros. I'm telling you, it is a snowball effect that we are seeing. LeBron commenting on it. Now we've got Little League directors saying we're not going to have the Astros.
So that means no Mets anytime soon or no Red Sox? Or are those the... Maybe about to. What if that comes down in the next couple months? Are they going to have to? We got to change our names now. We'll be the Butthawks.
And they kind of get left in the shadows here. I know that the Astros, they're the one that we all focus on, but they weren't the only ones that have been implicated in this cheating.
No, and Major League Baseball has not finished their investigation into the Red Sox. My question is this: we're in a time of the year where we just had the NBA All-Star break. We got college basketball going on. We've got NFL draft stuff going on. And Major League Baseball is dominating the sports news cycle. When's the last time something in Major League Baseball happened that dominated the news cycle like this? We're not talking about... This is multiple weeks of this.
It would have been the... probably the steroids and the PEDs.
So basically, for baseball to carry the sports conversation, they got to be cheating or... Something's got to be wrong with the game.
Or Sosa and McGuire.
He's saying in the offseason. That would have been, when Game of Shadows came out, I mean, that dominated. Dominated the entire offseason. Nothing positive has ever taken up these kind of airwaves that had to do with Major League Baseball.
When you guys were in Little League, would you hope for like a certain team that you would be designated?
I think there was more teams I didn't want. But they never had the A's really, which is the team that I always wanted. But then when a team would get a new uniform, like when the White Sox changed to the sort of calligraphy look, you wanted to be on the White Sox. Like you wanted that look. And then there were teams that were just boring. Like, I mean, the Cubs uniforms were always boring in Little League.
Yeah.
You didn't want that. So there were definitely teams you wanted to be on just because of the uniform.
I was a member of the White Sox one year, and it was that new look that they had. And the coach bought us all fitted hats.
You thought you were the stuff, didn't you?
We did think we were the stuff. Now, I will say, when it's 101 degrees outside, and those black jerseys and those black hats, they do get a little warm, especially when you're behind the plate catching. But that's just interesting. I thought I would throw that out there, that Little Leagues are not letting their teams. When do they reinstate the Astros? Did they ever come back to these Little Leagues? When can they? Because that Astros, that's a good looking uniform. I do like the uniform a lot better than the uniform that they went to briefly with. I guess it was that era with Bagwell and Biggio, and they kind of went with the red and had some of that gold and black.
Has anyone gotten Mattress Mack's take on this whole thing?
I've not heard from Mattress Mack's. Tyson Fury, Deontay Wilder, the fight part two that's coming up on Saturday. Right, so I'm in. I'm gonna order the pay per view.
You're gonna get it?
I decided. Yeah, I tried to get my neighbor Gary to go in halvesies with me. He did not fully commit, but
really?
He said that he would watch.
Oh, so he won't help you pay for it, but he'll come over and watch. Come on, Gary. That's weak sauce.
I was like, do you want to do it? I said, I'm going to go ahead and get it. And that's where I made the mistake of going ahead and saying, yeah, I'm going to go ahead and get it. But, yeah.
You know what I like about this, though?
$79.
I've covered Deontay at every step of his career. I went out to Colorado when he was, before he went to the Olympics back in 2008. So I've seen every step of this journey. I think it's really cool. It's taken a long time. Because boxing has lost its steam in America. It's been far surpassed by MMA. But now that ESPN is handling this, I have seen more promotion for this fight than any other Deontay Wilder fight. Now, it's a second fight. It's a draw. These are two of the most charismatic guys in the heavyweight division and in all of boxing, so it's a promoter's dream. But to see it getting some play on ESPN, I like it because I've covered every step since 2007, 2008, and this is the first time I've seen it.
So I was thinking about the measurables with these two guys. So Deontay Wilder, his reach is at 83 inches, Tyson Fury at 85. I actually had a tape measure yesterday, and I split the difference, just imagining how long those arms are. Goodness gracious.
That's 7 feet tall.
It's nuts.
Yeah, and with his athleticism, he sort of uses this. It's not really a jump, but he can actually close, so he can be real far away, and he's measuring you with that left-hand jab. And if he gets the measurement on you, it's over.
So those two, they squared off yesterday as far as the press conference, the things that we see in boxing typically leading up to the big event, which is going to be coming up on Saturday. The guy here from the state of Alabama, Deontay Wilder, yesterday.
I don't buy nothing he says. The only thing that I believe in Tyson Fury that he said is that you got to nail him to his coffin. And like I said, I brought 6-feet-inch nails and a big hammer from Alabama.
It's a long nail. 6-foot nail?
A 6-foot nail? I've seen a 6-inch nail. A 6-foot long nail. That would, the hammer from Alabama.
He is going to have to knock him out to win the fight.
Yep.
Deontay Wilder will have to knock Tyson Fury out to win the fight.
He can't outpoint him there.
Do you think that a guy like Tyson, we saw what he was able to take in the first fight, didn't think he could get up from that. I don't think anybody else would. Is he capable of being knocked out?
No, absolutely. I do believe it's a big advantage for him to be able to go in this fight and know what that is and know how that feels and know what that's going to be like. Because I think if you're fighting Deontay Wilder and you've seen what he's done to a lot of other people, and you haven't been in that ring with him before, that has to be in the back of your mind. It has to be in the back of your mind that if you take one of those right hands, you're done.
Lights out.
And that changes your approach. That changes your aggression. That changes your defense. It changes the amount of offense that you can put on your opponent. So it changes everything when you're in the ring. And I believe that's a big advantage for Tyson Fury. Now, what kind of shape's he in? What does he look like late in later rounds, that's yet to be determined, but I do anticipate Tyson Fury to be in a little bit better shape than he was the last time around.
I know that these two guys are not as polarizing as a Mike Tyson, Evander Holyfield. You go back to George Foreman and some of those fights.
It's a different era. People just don't watch boxing.
Yeah, they don't watch it as much. But is it just because Deontay Wilder, and he's being from this state, and I know that most people in this state, they follow him. Do you think that this fight, as far as build up and excitement, anticipation, is probably bigger than, I don't know, anything in boxing that we've seen in the past three, 4 years?
Not
unfortunately.
Mayweather
and McGregor.
No.
And then before that, Mayweather and Pacquiao was far surpassed this. It's just the heavyweight didn't have any juice, and they're trying, these two guys. And, you know, they had with Fury and Wilder, and then you got Anthony Joshua. You felt pretty good that you had a solid basis for the heavyweight division. But, you know, with Anthony Joshua and their camp always sort of delaying, fighting Wilder, and now he got beat. That didn't have as much steam. Again, how much we're in this state. How much do you read about? Have you read any story on AO.com about Deontay Wilder this week? He's the heavyweight champion in our backyard.
NFL playoff expansion. That is the news. First of all, do we need more teams in the NFL playoffs? Do we need four extra teams? Is that going to drive viewership?
Do we need four extra teams? No, definitely not.
We just need a couple extra teams. Do you like the way
the playoff is right now? But I mean, the playoff that's been proposed, I think it could be okay. You're giving one less team a bye. Do we feel like two teams earn a bye over the course of a season in each conference? Probably. I think it's going to depend on the season. I mean, you look back at this past season. Do I think the Rams and Steelers deserve to be in the playoffs? No. I was telling you guys midseason that when Pittsburgh was kind of fighting for their lives, I don't even want to see this team in the playoffs because I'm afraid of what would happen. You would have had Steelers Chiefs last year. I mean, what would that game would have looked like? That wouldn't have been fun. Rams Packers. I don't know if that would have been a game that would have been competitive or fun to watch. So I don't know if we need two byes. Now you're going to get more games on wild card weekend. You'll get three on Saturday and three on Sunday. That could be a plus. That could be fun. I mean, two triple headers on that weekend. That could be cool. But I think the NFL playoff schedule is great as it is now. However, you're talking about a lot of playoff bonuses. You're talking about a lot of teams that could get hot and potentially make a run. So the way that it's laid out, I'm not completely against it. I don't think it's terrible. I just kind of like the way that it is now. So I don't feel like we're desperate for change.
I would be all for more playoff games during wild card weekend. I like that. I don't like only one team getting a bye. That seems like a really huge advantage for that one team, which is part of it, right? That's why you want the one seed. But
that's going to keep people from sitting guys late in the season. Yeah. You're going to if it's close, you're going to play your starters and you're going to go out and try to win in weeks 15, 16.
I just think we're trying to solve a problem that isn't a problem.
Well, why are we seeing this? Because we've already seen Major League Baseball suggest a new playoff and how they would do the
wild
card.
They're trying to expand money, man.
I mean, it's all money driven, right?
It's all growth. You have to find a way to grow. They haven't adjusted the playoffs since 2002, so you're looking for new innovative ways. And listen, here's the other part. Those TV deals are coming up. The TV rights are coming up. How much more valuable are your TV rights with extra playoff games? A lot more valuable. Every network wants playoff games. So if you can be able to go to more networks and offer more playoff games or give networks that haven't had one or want one or want to get in the mix for that, whoever that is, all of a sudden the price of what you're offering skyrockets. To me, that's the ultimate part of what we're doing here.
And what I really don't like is 17 games by only taking one preseason game away. I don't think they need three preseason games. They could probably get what they need to get done in two to go to camp with guys that haven't made the team. You give them two games to make the team. You get the starters some work. I mean, they're not playing more than a half in those games anyway. If I'm a player, I'm concerned about an extra game just because how dangerous football is in terms of being able to stay healthy for an entire season. Now you're going to give me one more game and also add a format where those games are going to matter at the end of the season and teams are going to not shut it down. I don't. If I was the NFLPA, I wouldn't love this proposal.
Well, it's human nature for us to resist change. A lot of people just don't like change.
Sure.
And we fight it and we push against it, especially when it comes to our sports. But look at the NCAA tournament and expanding to 68 and getting that first night that we get of that, those couple of nights that we get leading up to the tournament.
Yeah, for sure. What's your most memorable first night game?
I knew this.
Tell me about
coming.
It.
No,
you walked right into this one, Landrum.
No, I'm what I'm saying is it's an extra night to watch basketball.
Oakland Santa Barbara game. That was an exciting.
But it doesn't feel like it's part of the tournament because it's in his own location.
In Dayton?
It doesn't take place where all the other games are on, the same date as the other games. It's always felt like...
What's on True TV?
Oh, by the way, there's this that starts before the real tournament starts.
That Arizona State team Bobby Hurley had, that's where they got their start. And they went on a run, started playing good basketball. I know what you're saying.
There's two ways to look at this, and I understand where you're going. And you look at under the current playoff system, like I said, that's been in place since 2002, there have been 10-win teams miss the playoffs. So we would probably look at that and say, those teams deserved a chance to play for a title. You get double-digit wins in the NFL, it's really good. Circumstance is going to have it sometimes that doesn't take place. But if you were to go to that seventh seed, just over the last few years, I'll take you through who that would have been the last few years. Last year, I mentioned Steelers and Rams, 8-8, 9-7. 2018, Steelers, Vikings, 9-6-1, 8-7-1. 2017, Ravens, Lions, both 9-7. 2016, Titans, Bucks, both 9-7. 2015, yeah, you get the Jets in at 10-6, but the Falcons are in at 8-8. 2014, you get a 9-7 Texans team, a 10-6 Eagles team. 2013, you get a 10-6 Cardinals team in, but you get an 8-8 Steelers team in. 2012, 10-6 Bears team in. That's great. 8-8 Steelers team's going. It's a juggling act of, yes, every now and then there's another team that we probably would believe is playoff worthy that could go win a couple of games in the postseason. But is that worth putting 500 teams in a lot of the time? Or teams that are a game above 500 most of the time? Anonymous wants to join us on the Bud Light Seltzer Hotline. Welcome in, Anonymous.
Good morning, guys. How are y'all doing today?
Great, thanks.
Better than Greg Robinson and Quan Bray.
Yeah, obviously so. But enjoy the show. But I worked in the rental car industry for a little over 10 years. And this happened all the time. All the time.
As far as the cars getting taken in, impounded, I guess?
Yes.
Oh, my.
Yes, 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 yes.
So when you say all the time, give us a number of, like, occurrences a month or a year.
Once a month.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I had a buddy that I worked out with in Huntsville. He worked out at our gym and came in one day and told us he was late because... he had to rent a car, and when he opened the trunk to put his stuff in there, there was just a 12-gauge sitting in the trunk.
Whoa.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
He had to go through the whole police deal. Yeah.
What was the red flag, Anonymous, when you were in the car rental business? Like, hey, I'd like a cargo van. I'll have it back.
Well, they always wanted very nondescript vehicles with specific state tags. You know, it was ever, you got anything that's got a Texas license plate on there? You know, so they
wow,
wanted to
just
do their
asking.
Best to blend in. So,
did you have the discretion when they were being pretty blatant about it to not rent them a car?
Yes.
Yeah, because you're going to lose that vehicle, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's going to get tore up because it's going to get searched. And, yeah, I mean, I had instances where customers would straight up tell me, yeah, my nephew's going to have this, and he's got to run here. And I'm like, no. No.
Yeah, they do. They rip those cars apart. They got all the tools, too. Yeah. It's like working in a body shop. They take all the seats out, upholstery.
Seats are out.
Yep.
Everything in here is like, I can't even drive this thing back. But, yeah, it happens a lot more than you think.
I appreciate the phone call. Did they inspect the gas tank? We've seen them in tires.
There's all kind of compartments that people can have made custom. Not when you rent a car, I would assume. It's just some bags in the back. It's bad. Worst thing I've seen.
Three Man Front. Weekdays 10 till 2 on Jocks 94.5, JocksFM.com, and the Jocks mobile app.